This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today it's a special edition of The Wheelhouse. Governor Dan Malloy joins us for the first time in his second term to take some of your questions, and we'll get to your questions at 860-275-7266. Again, you can call us at 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Governor Malloy, welcome back to our studio. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been here.
I know it has been a while. It's good to see you. You know, during two of the most recent interviews like this that you did on Dennis House's program and on Chaz and AJ, I couldn't help but notice that you brought them beer. So I'm just wondering, did you bring a nice thing from Hooker or maybe from New England Brewing? Yeah, what did you bring
me
today?
If I was going to bring you something, it would be from probably Hooker.
So, okay.
But I didn't. I didn't swing by this morning. I was fearful they wouldn't be open.
Okay. Well, next time. Next time.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much. So there's
I mean, that's a serious issue. We in Connecticut, we pay too much and we are unfairly charged for alcohol. And I know that the legislature is reluctant to do anything about it, but you know that people in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and New York can buy spirits substantially less expensively than we can really is not fair to the consumer. We wouldn't tolerate a conspiracy amongst auto dealers or amongst clothes sellers that artificially inflate prices, but for some reason Connecticut people are willing to do it in this particular industry. Doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, maybe that's something that people will talk about when we take calls and questions at 860-275-7266. There's a lot to talk about.
Sure.
About your budget. There's a lot to talk about your transportation plan. I want to start with something that we've been talking a lot about this week. Earlier this week on a show, I've got another program actually coming up tomorrow at the Mark Twain House talking about youth incarceration. And this is your plan for what you're calling a second chance society. Your plan would, among other things, integrate nonviolent offenders back into their communities, change some of the pardon and parole system, classify drug possession charges as misdemeanors unless there's an intent to sell. Why is this one of your priorities right now?
Because it should be. And it has been, actually, in the first 4 years. Let's remember, we decriminalized marijuana. There's 6,000 fewer arrests per year in Connecticut as a result of that simple change, which means that a lot of people are not ending up with a record that they otherwise would end up with. And that's an important first step. You know, between in a 15-year period, we tripled the population in our jails. Toward what end? As we've actually started to back people out of jail, our crime rate's actually falling. Recidivism is going down. Homicides in New Haven, Bridgeport, and Hartford are down 48%. Violent crime overall is down 36% since I was elected, and we're in a position to have fewer people in jail. Why do we do these other things? We can't bring our urban environments back if you basically say to 10 to 20% of a region's population, you're not eligible for student loan, you're not eligible for housing, and you're not eligible for a job. And by the way, stay where you are and don't cause any trouble. Doesn't work. And so it's time for us to return to what we were founded as, a second chance society. I mean, as I frequently say when I'm talking about this issue, if you're not a Native American and if you weren't brought here in slavery, then your people came here for a second chance. You know, we invented bankruptcy laws here to give people a second chance. I want to return to that. I want to say, listen, you commit a crime, there is a price to pay, but that doesn't need to be a permanent price. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't mean that you're never going to have a job again. So I'm trying to take initial steps. We've taken some initial steps, some additional steps, and quite frankly, we could take additional steps in the years to come to return ourselves to this concept of pay your price and get back in line and get a job and live a good life.
Maybe I can get some details from you on one specific piece of this that we've been talking a lot about as well. Last legislative session, the lawmakers took up a bill but did not pass it called Second Look legislation. It would offer the possibility of parole for people serving long sentences for crimes that they committed as minors. Right now, the state seems to be out of compliance with the U.S. Supreme Court ruling along these lines. Are you going to push for Second Look legislation to pass during the session?
Well, you know, am I going to push? I think they should pass appropriate legislation to bring our approach and our treatment of juvenile offenders in line with what the United States Supreme Court has ordered. So, of course, they should do that. I think they'll get something out. I hope they'll get something out. I certainly am prepared to sign legislation that would put us in compliance with that wonderful Constitution that we believe in.
Why do you pause when I ask, are you going to push? I mean, are you going to push for it? Are you going to come out in front and say, I think you should do this?
I have said this because you're asking me a question that I've already spoken about in the past. They should pass this legislation. I said it last session. I said it the session before. I said it this session. We should be in compliance with the United States Constitution.
Well, one of the parts of your Second Chance Society plan would shift some positions, more than 1,000 positions, out of the Court Support Services Division of the Judicial Branch and actually put them either in the Department of Corrections or the Department of Children and Families. Why this move of personnel under this plan?
Because that's where the positions actually belong. We have a legislative branch, we have an executive branch, and we have a judicial branch. Because our executive branch was broken for a long time, a lot of things got done elsewhere. And the legislature would designate, in some senses, around governors who were not particularly supportive of taking the steps that I've already taken or already outlined. They ended up in the judiciary as a way to make sure that the money got spent. Those are, by and large, executive functions, not judicial functions. And we'll have some discussions in the coming weeks and months about what the right level of that is. But I'm giving you the actual explanation. That's what the legislature did. They knew they had governors who weren't going to do the kinds of things that we needed to do to change our approach to criminal justice. I obviously have shown a pretty wide willingness to do this, and in fact of pushing the envelope. Listen, the legislature passed laws about 16 and 17 year olds being returned to the juvenile court system. It was my administration that actually had to implement that, and there was a lot of pressure, if you remember, on me to not do that. And there was even discussion in that 2010 race about rolling that change back. Obviously, I believe we need criminal justice reform, and I think properly having positions in the right form of government, whether it's legislative, judicial, or executive, is important.
Well, one of the things I was reading, though, from the Democrat who leads the House of Representatives, Brendan Sharkey, he says, and this is something he told the New Haven Register, "Everything I understand about the programs run by the judicial branch is that they are doing a terrific job. I don't see the point of what this will accomplish." And he suggests, and I think many other people will suggest, that despite the changes in the executive branch over the years, Governor, that the DCF itself has not always been the most efficient or the most well-functioning department to accomplish some of these things.
I don't think there's actually evidence of that with respect to criminal justice. So I'm asking you to tell me what you would relate that to with respect to criminal justice, because there really isn't history. Listen, DCF is probably the hardest job in any of the 50 states. That there's just a reality of that. With respect to better coordination between the executive branch, particularly with respect to the handling of prisoners or people who are in incarceration systems, that's where that job should be. But, listen, it'll be talked about and people make their decisions.
We're talking with Governor Dan Malloy today. He's here for a whole hour, and we're going to take some of your questions in a moment at 860-275-7266. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live if you'd like to get your questions in. So let's talk about your budget. You've called your budget a tough budget. It does include hundreds of millions of dollars in cuts. We're going to get to some of those specifics in a moment. But first, let's get to some of the details around it. Your budget chief has sent out an apology, I guess it's a few weeks ago now, that suggests that because they got the numbers wrong, the state is actually over the statutory spending cap. How do you propose to address that?
Well, first of all, we don't have to. The executive branch doesn't have to submit a budget that is in compliance with that cap. But that's the legislator's job, that they have to deliver a budget that is in compliance. Our requirement is that we propose a balanced budget, and that's what we did. There was a vendor picked the wrong quarter to measure the amount of growth. We discovered it, not anybody else, and we brought it forward. So there are going to be lots of changes. Neither you or I think the legislature is going to adopt my budget as presented, I think. The budget is before the legislature, and they're going to make changes up and down. So far, we've made about $590 million in cuts in the same services budget. So far, all I've heard is complaints about that the cuts that we've made. That roughly puts us in compliance, plus or minus $50 or $60 million out of, in round numbers, a $20,000 million budget. Let's call it what it is. And I think the legislature is up to doing that.
Well, why shouldn't you, though, deliver a budget that's under the spending cap?
Well, there's no legal requirement that we do that.
There's no legal requirement, but shouldn't you, as governor, leading this charge, because they're waiting for you to give the budget, shouldn't you put forward a budget that's under the spending cap?
I gave a budget, it's before them, and neither you or I or any of your listeners have any expectation that the legislature is going to pass the budget as I gave them, and you're smiling as I say that. So I think you get it. I get it. It's off my desk. It's before them. They're already having hearings. They're already penciling things they like and things that they don't like. And ultimately, we'll have a round of discussions about how to bring the budget in compliance in many different ways with respect to what our goals are.
What's the cap for? I mean, shouldn't we take a real hard look at what the spending cap in the state is all about?
Sure. I mean, I gave an option to the legislature last year or the year before, I can't remember exactly which now, that we should have excluded from the spending cap the extra money that we're paying into the pension system to undo the harm that was done by other administrations in underfunding the pension plan. So in essence, what we're doing is we're going to harm people today to make up for the money that was not paid when it should have been, and that's affecting the spending cap. The legislature, you know, they agreed with me that the Medicaid money coming to the state should be excluded, but they didn't agree with that, and that's a decision they made. They're going to have to live with it.
We're talking with Governor Dana Malloy. We're getting Facebook messages, and we're going to take some phone calls in a moment. One other quick issue that that came up recently is that Denise Napier, the state treasurer, has questioned part of your plan to rely on about $325 million in borrowed money to make contractual payments on state debt. Essentially, she seems to be saying that we'd be paying higher than normal interest rates on the borrowing. She suggests that could harm our standing on Wall Street, potentially put the budget out of balance. How do you respond to the treasurer?
I think she's wrong. She's been wrong about how much debt service requirement we would have. She's been routinely wrong on that point, but she's being conservative, and I understand that. So, you know, I suppose the question is, should we take numbers that we know are wrong and use them in the budget, and therefore have to make additional cuts to social services, or should we try to get it right?
But I just asked you about the spending cap, and we're using numbers that are wrong to present a budget. I mean, we are right now using numbers that are wrong, and we're presenting something to a legislature, and the legislature is going to do with it what they want, right?
I think we have a fundamental disagreement. The law is very clear. The budget I have to present is balanced, and it is balanced. We've met our legal requirement. The legislature has to present a budget that lives within the cap. That's their legal requirement. Those are two different legal requirements. If we budgeted all expense items or all revenue items the wrong way, then we'd have a distorted budget. What we're trying to do is get the budget right, have the least amount of cuts in areas that you know are really very dear to me. Quite frankly, it's not a great budget. We have a spending cap issue. We also have a revenue cap issue, and or not revenue, but a cap, but a revenue issue. We know how much money we can bring in. That's causing us to do some things that, as I said in my speech when I delivered the budget, that under perfect circumstances we would not want to do or have to do.
Given some of these really tough cuts that we'll be talking about, I know people will have questions about, why, again, just so that our listeners understand, why did you prioritize some borrowing to pay off debts in favor of providing services? Because if we can borrow money to pay off debts, some advocates are certainly asking, why can't we borrow money to provide services for people who need them?
We have caps that ultimately have to be complied with. And when we presented the budget, we thought we were in compliance, and we're out of compliance slightly on that item. But that's not a legal requirement. I think the issue, and maybe you should have other people on to talk about this. But in round numbers, we are in a period where bonded debt is sold at a very, very low rate. And the marketplace is requiring ways to make sure that the bond holders or buyers are properly or sufficiently rewarded. Sometimes that leads to bond premiums being paid. Bond premiums are used, in essence, to pay debt. It's not to fund the services of government. Now you could push back and say, well, if you didn't use that money to pay bonded debt, you could use it to pay operations. Well, that's not what we're doing. I mean, you can make any argument you want, but that's not what's happening.
We get a Facebook comment here from Janice who says, I want you to ask him why he won't raise taxes on people making over $500,000 a year. He said after his first term he wouldn't punish prosperity. That's not prosperity. He's balancing the budget on the backs of the middle class, poor, and the developmentally disabled. That's a Facebook comment from Janice. What do you say to her?
I would say that, Janice, that we've done a pretty good job in raising revenue. That's what certainly the first 4 years were about. Certainly the first 2 years were about. By and large, we're spending more money on supporting people with disabilities and others, including pre-K through 12 education in the state at a substantially higher rate than we were when I was elected. Sometimes you have to make tough choices, and that's a choice that I have to make. The legislature now has the possibility of looking at how they want to do these things. And as I said, they all disagree with many disagreements with respect to some of the tough choices we've had to make. But let me assure you, the legislature is going to have to make some tough choices as well.
Couldn't one of the tough choices be changing the top rate for the income tax for the top earners, as Janice suggested, that are making over $500,000 a year?
There are lots of things that could be included in any discussion that the legislature wants to have with itself, member to member, and that's their job. I had to get the budget out by February 18th. I complied with that, and it was balanced. The legislature's got to send back a budget if they're going to live within the time frame to us and time for us to sign it prior to July 1st. There's a lot of things that are going to happen between now and then. Deficits will go up. Deficits will go down. The popularity of one cut or the popularity of one expenditure will go up and down and will go back and forth. But this is something, you know, this is the rough equivalent of sausage being made over a long period of time, and people will observe and people will comment. And I hope that the legislature will take all of those things into consideration. Certainly, I'll take all of those things into consideration. But it really is up to the legislature at this point.
Would you sign a bill if it came to your desk that changes the tax rate for the top earners in the state?
Listen, I am not advocating a tax increase. In fact, I'm advocating tax decreases. As you know, I'd like to get to the lowest possible sales taxes. I think it would put us in a competitive advantage situation with some of the states that surround us. I think having the lowest sales tax rate would invite additional sales to take place in our state and in some senses would help pay for itself and maybe more and would bring specific relief and greater relief to the middle class, quite frankly. So that's part of my package. So I don't think we're as far apart as the question would necessarily suggest. She talks about a burden on the middle class. I'm trying to raise that. And one of the I'm trying to eliminate some of that. And one of the best ways to do that would be to get the lowest possible overall sales tax.
Just very quickly, you answered a slightly different question. I was just asking, if a bill came to your desk that raised the rate for the top earners in the state, would you sign it?
I am not advocating it, and I'm unlikely to support it, but I'd have to see what the legislature's deliberations were about.
Governor Daniel Malloy joins us. When we come back, lots of questions from you at 860-275-7266. You can also ask your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll be right back. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're here with Governor Dan Malloy. He's the governor of the state of Connecticut, and he's joining us to take some of your calls and questions on Where We Live. We're also live on CTN, the Connecticut Network, as I find out now. Hello, everyone watching on CTN. Let's get to some phone calls from listeners. Ed's in Oakville. Hi, Ed.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I was going to ask the governor. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
If you would stand by the respite budget, there's a small amount of money. I know sometimes that sounds trivial, but we are looking at $2 million, and the cut is in for 25% already.
Yep.
And these people collectively, there's 172,000 home caregivers, and they save our budget, if you will, $2 billion a year. And I just wanted to try and, you know,
I am absolutely standing by it. Absolutely, as budgeted, we think it's important. Listen, it's not a cut that anyone wants to see made. We are trying to find ways to be supportive of home caregivers. And, there have been years, I believe, when the entire account was not exhausted. But I absolutely believe that we need some level of respite care.
Ed, thank you very much for your phone call. Selena's in Hartford. Hi, Selena.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
How are you? My concern is not about the budget. The question that you asked him before that was that if a person has gone to prison, done his time, and made it, you know, because obviously you have to do your time if you did the crime. But you said that you were trying to make things easier for people that actually have came out of prison and, you know, actually can find jobs to stay out of trouble.
Yes.
Well, my biggest concern is that I have my fiance that has been trying all his for the past 8 years. He got in trouble, and it wasn't something drastic, but, you know, he did, it was one felony, and basically he was carrying brass knuckles in a car, and he got charged for them, obviously, because it was called a weapon. Nothing was used, no one, he didn't do excessive jail time. He just paid a fine, mm-hmm. and he's been, that's been haunting him for the past 8 years, because I've been trying to help him and find resources to help him, you know, fix his record, and no one is, like, no one is trying to help me, and that's wrong, because he's a good man, and he's trying to provide for him and my four kids, and, you know, no one, basically, everyone I ask, I go to the courts, I go to everywhere, and everyone's just turning my back, and it's not right that, you know, if we trying to do, you know, a better life, and he's trying to stay out of trouble instead of having to go to the streets and, you know, trying to make money. Right. You know, he's trying to live as a productive citizen, well, and no one is helping.
So, Selena, thank you very much. Go ahead, Governor.
So, I mean, I think that, listen, Selena, I really don't know your boyfriend's situation or what happened. But those are some of the situations that potentially we'd like to address. I think we treat violent offenses in most cases differently than we treat nonviolent offenses. The possession of those of that weapon under those circumstances is probably looked at as a violent offense. But I think pardons and parole should be able to look at these situations in their entirety. If somebody's paid the price for the offense and they've lived a good life for a period of years after that, that's why we should have pardons and paroles, and that's why we should be in a position to give people a second chance. Now, I think, you know, the further you go up on the violence level, the less likely that is to work or to be the case. But people, you know, I had a line in the speech that we as a society have become more focused on permanent punishment than permanent reform. And I think that permanent reform really should be our target. And if we're going to affect permanent reform in a larger number of people, we need to give them assistance with respect to job acquisition, with respect to housing acquisition, and quite frankly, in many cases, with respect to clearing their record.
Thank you very much for your call, Selena. Stanley's in Bristol. Hi, Stanley.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind, Stanley?
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I understand that, you know, with this new budget, we're going to be making all these tough choices. But my question is, if we're making all these tough choices, why did he give $1.4 million in raises to his political appointees?
Sure.
Money could have been used in the budget.
Sure, let me answer it. Those political employees didn't have a raise for 4 years. Nobody else in government was in that category. It had gotten to the point where many of those political appointees had large staffs of people who were making substantially more than they were. And I knew that I needed to attract some people to those types of positions to replace that workforce. So the idea that we should treat one portion of our workforce differently than we treat 99.9% of it simply didn't make a lot of sense. Again, I want to go back to this. That was the one group of people who didn't have a raise in 4 years. Now, let's also examine a little bit further, because we did. If a person changed a job and as a result got an increase in pay during that period of time, they did not get the full increase that people who were totally flat and didn't get a promotion. So we tried to do it in as effective and as fair a way as possible. And I certainly wasn't going to go for another 4 years. So we'd ask people to work for the same amount of money over an 8-year period while their peers would have had raises in 6 of those 8 years. I wasn't prepared to do that because I don't think it makes sense. And I think it ultimately devalues the job and makes it harder to fill the job.
I think what Stanley and many others might ask, though, as far as in a tough choices budget, what message it sends, given the fact that there's an awful lot of people out there who haven't had raises in the private sector for a very, very, very long time.
There are, although, you know, quite frankly, the average salary went up to $20 a month in Connecticut last year. So let's put it all in perspective. You know, you're dealing with averages. You're dealing with
we have some very high income earners in the state. I mean,
sure we do.
Yeah, and that's where an awful lot of the money is accruing. There's a lot of people at the poorer middle class who haven't had a raise, Governor, in a very long time.
I understand that, I suppose that's a reason that no one here at this station or in this operation has gotten a raise in 8 years.
I don't take your point.
The point is that you have to compete for employment. You have to compete for the right personnel to fill jobs. And what I made very clear at the outset of the administration was that we were not going to – first of all, we were going to have fewer people work in my side of government, which we honored, and that if you came on board, don't expect an increase over the next 4 years. I didn't say to people, don't expect an increase over an 8-year period of time.
Yeah. Now, I just when you said about the people here, just so everyone knows, we got a 2% increase here in our company. But I'm not setting budgetary policy for the entire state. That's not my job. I mean, the reason I asked you the question is, should the governor's office be a place that sends a message about what a tough choice really is?
Well, should an organization that is supported by the public and by government be giving 2% raises? I think the reality is there is a common ground and a similar situation. You're out trying to raise money from people on a daily basis.
We are.
In every one of those pitches, do you tell people that you're raising people's salaries?
Usually, yeah. I do it almost every morning, as a matter of fact, when I'm on. You should listen during the fundraiser.
I think we get the we get one another's points, and I think that it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we're filling positions with people with proper qualifications for those jobs, and that we can compete with the marketplace, and that's what we did. We did not give a raise for 4 years.
Last year, you signed into law about $275 million in tax cuts during the campaign that were supposed to go into effect this year. Some of those tax cuts are being pushed off. Can you explain why they're being pushed off now?
Well, they're not necessarily being pushed off. That's a decision for the legislature to make.
But they're being pushed off in your budget,
yep.
In your budget plan.
Right, because we've actually rethought the issues. Most of that is specifically in the area of sales tax. And in the area of sales tax, we believe that it would better serve Connecticut financially, that is inviting sales back into the state from surrounding communities, if we got to the lowest possible sales tax rate. What we have proposed is the lowest possible sales tax rate would be 5.95 that we would get to over a 2-year period of time, which we believe will bring the largest level of relief to the middle class. Not everybody buys a car, but if you buy a car, that makes a difference. And if you apply it to all of your purchases opposed to just clothing allowance, then it has a pretty broad impact. So some of that is built into that. And quite frankly, some of it is to allow further growth in revenue over the total period of the biennium of the budget, which is a 2-year. Our state does a 2-year budget. A lot of states don't. And so we're trying to get to the best public policy that we think is the strongest promoter of our state economy.
But so we wouldn't see that sales tax decrease for another couple years.
No, you would see it. You would see it in the entirety would be in the biennium.
The entirety in the biennium. But when would we start realizing the change in the sales tax rate that we are paying for goods and services? For goods.
Yeah, sometime the first year, and then the second part would be point. I don't actually have the date.
The reason I ask is I think a lot of people might ask you, if last year we said that we were going to be getting tax relief this year, and this year the tax relief gets pushed off down the road, why would we expect that the tax relief is actually going to come in a year or 2 years?
Because it would be built into the biennium budget, and it is a different approach and one that actually I think works better for more people in the state. On the other hand, you know, we can cut another $200 million out of the budget if that's what people are prepared to do this year and what they want to do this year. But I think, you know, we're in a tough spot, and we're going to be in a tough spot. And I think state governments overall in all 50 states are going to be a tough spot for a long period of time. And that is that, by and large, costs are growing larger, faster than revenue is. And so you try to find the right balance, and you try to present it in such a way that ultimately we get to lower taxes, particularly with respect to sales tax, that actually are promoting of the economy, which adds jobs and growth to it. You know, retail sector is one of our largest sectors in the state of Connecticut. And you make those kinds of judgments about how much you can cut any one place or any series of places, and you try to take all of that into consideration. That's what making a budget is. And now that's before the legislature, and they'll make those decisions. Then we'll sit down at some point after they've done all of their deliberations, and we'll figure it out. But, you know, there are lots of people who are complaining that the cuts are too deep already. You make another $200 million worth of cuts, it's going to be that much more difficult.
But what substantively changed between last year at this time when you and I talked about a looming $3 billion budget deficit over the next 2 years, when you said there wasn't going to be a budget deficit? And at the time, at the time we had projections from the OFA that there was going to be a $3 billion budget deficit over 2 years. And you said to me that there wasn't, that projection was wrong. And we just talked about tax cuts that you proposed at that time and actually put into law for this time around. And now we are making deep cuts into state government And we're also changing some of our tax structure because that hole that we said was going to be there a year ago is actually here. What changed between now and
then? Well, it's not here. We don't have a deficit. We're not going to have a deficit. I mean, the use of the word deficit is improperly used. And since you're so good with language, you know, to sit here while you're misusing it is quite exceptional. What it showed was that if you increase spending at 7.3%, you wouldn't have enough money to do it. And I said when I was here, and you should remember this, that we're not going to increase spending by 7.3%.
But you didn't say you were going to cut hundreds of thousands of dollars out of the state – or hundreds of millions of dollars out of state government programs.
Well, I certainly said that by implication. If I said we're not going to raise spending by 7.3%, and that's the one – that's the number that represented what you're calling a deficit, which would be actually a revenue shortfall because you don't have a deficit until the end of the day, not at the beginning of the day. Of course, that's what I said. I said we're not going to increase spending at 7.3%. Of course, we have to make cuts under that situation. Listen, my administration has had average increases in spending under 3% so far in the 4 years that I've been in office. This budget increases spending over the biennium about 3.1% over the 2 years. That's substantially lower than what was happening in the go-go great days where, quite frankly, people made commitments that they should never have made to begin with. And so I'm trying to bring some level of fiscal sanity to the situation. Now, listen, here I sit. I get banged up because we're making cuts. I get banged up because I'm not raising taxes. I get banged up because I'm raising taxes. You know, I understand it. It's the job I ran for. But let's be very clear. What I said when I was last here is that we would not increase spending by 7.3%, and we're not.
You suggested, though, that the OFA's projections weren't right. That this projected budget deficit actually wasn't correct. And I guess I'm just trying to figure out – I understand the semantics around what a deficit actually is, but we're now at a point where we're making those cuts to accomplish that. Your budget chief has said we're in a state of permanent fiscal crisis, and I guess this time last year that's not what we were hearing when we talked.
I fundamentally disagree with you, and I'm giving you specific examples. Those projections would require that we increase spending by 7.3%. I was very clear in debates here and elsewhere that under no circumstances would we increase spending by 7.3%? Of course we needed to make cuts to that quote-unquote same services budget. By the way, and I specifically pointed out, there was an item in that projection that said, well, we're going to have an inflationary adjustment of about $300 million. Now, I've never budgeted $300 million or any amount on an inflationary basis. You actually try to pick line by line what the actual expenditure is, not simply assume that there is a large quote-unquote inflationary addition, particularly in an environment where I'm trying to create a government that's substantially more efficient so that it actually does more with less money. And quite frankly, that's somewhat is what's behind some of the changes that we're making.
Do you agree with your budget chief that we're in a state of permanent fiscal crisis?
I think we're in a situation – I probably wouldn't have said it that way, but I think this is the reality. I think the point that he's trying to get at, and that is that revenues are growing are not growing as rapidly as expenses are. And I think that that has been true on a long-term basis over the last 5 years and likely is to be true over the next 5 years, which requires a balanced approach of making when it comes to making a budget of where can you create efficiencies so you're actually saving money. When you save that money, where do you spend it as opposed to simply cut it? What do you do to make your economy more vibrant, to bring in more revenue? This is a balancing act, and that's what we're trying to do.
Some of the folks, before we take our break, we've got some more phone calls here. Some of the folks that I've talked to surrounding the budget plans that you put in, and again, these are now in the legislature's hands.
Some of the folks.
I'm talking to advocates. I'm talking to people who are social service workers.
Sure.
I'm talking to people who feel deep cuts. So one of the things they're saying when we talk about the economic vitality of the state is if we cut back on education programs right now, that gets right at the core of the economic vitality of the state. What do you say?
Well, that's why we're fully funding ECS. That's why we're not passing on on our economic difficulties to local governments and local boards of education to make their issues that much more problematic, particularly in a state that is very reliant on property taxes. So any aid that we cut to cities and towns, particularly on the formulaic basis, which is ECS, Education Cost Sharing Grant, would have a very direct and difficult impact on communities and would likely lead to raising of property taxes, which I think is actually a problem in Connecticut, not a help.
Yeah. Let's go to Thea, who's calling from Vernon. Hi, Thea.
Oh, hi. This is Thea Cardamone. I'm very interested in the question on the elderly that are new into the plan for home care, because I read that you were going to cut them off and they would no longer be eligible. And I'm just wondering why you would do that when that seems to me to force them into the alternative, which would be inpatient or, you know, assisted living with Medicaid, and they'd have to go to the state to get Medicaid for, you know, full living expenses. Isn't it cheaper to have somebody come to someone's home in the long run?
Well, there are a couple of things going on there. Number one, if they're elderly, although they could be eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare, they're probably a larger portion, if not all of that cost, would be Medicare, which is a federal expense, not a state expense. But there are a couple of other things going on here, and that is that we are creating other options in the budget, for instance, for alternative housing. This is a budget that has about $450 million over the biennium to continue the buildup of housing, including supportive housing, including elderly housing that is designed to keep people in homes, if not their home, in a home that's properly sized with the accommodations necessary to allow an elderly person to maintain the largest level of independence as they can. We also have extensively increased the number of people who qualify for rental assistance. We did that last year, and this is a program that's allowing more and more people to stay in home and address it. I suppose that what I would say to you is I am very much desirous of having seniors stay home as long as they can and as long as they're comfortable, and I think that we're trying to take a across-the-board approach to that. On the other hand, you can't do all things at all times every day that you would like to. And so we're trying to make cuts in certain areas, particularly when we understand that we're offsetting those cuts in other areas, and that's what we're trying to do.
Thea, thanks for your phone call. Donna's in New Milford. Hi, Donna.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a little different question, which I realize everything you've been talking about is very important. But my concern is what's going on with the state police. In particular with Lieutenant Vance. This is a man who has done an exemplary job for 14 years. He's worked with the governor. In a time of crisis, people look to him much like they do look to the governor. He's a man who's been trusted. He's a man who's received accolades from around the world when he handled the Sandy Hook situation. He's done a good job, and I don't understand the reason why he's being removed from his job. Now, the colonel has said that the department is moving in a different direction. And I may be naive, but I've always believed that in any large organization, being it law enforcement or in the private sector, when you want to move into a new direction that is for the betterment of that organization, mm-hmm. you don't take an important link in the chain of that organization and just kick them to the curb.
Well, no one's being kicked to the curb, so let's be very clear about that. I like Paul Vance. I've worked with him over the 4 years that I've been governor. We have shared some very difficult situations. Ultimately, the state police is an organization that has its own leadership chain, and a decision is made to go in a different direction. No one's being kicked to the curb. In fact, Paul Vance has had a very distinguished career, which he can choose to continue. I think what's truly unusual about this situation is that one individual has occupied one position for a very long period of time. That doesn't normally happen in these situations, and that that may make it more difficult. But ultimately, as governor, I'm not going to make personnel decisions in every department, and you have to leave it up to somebody. And a decision's been made, and I think everybody understands that and is accepting of it at this point.
Donna, thanks for your phone call. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we want to talk transportation. The governor has laid out a big transportation plan that is going to span not just over the next few years, but over the next few decades, and we're going to try to get at some of these ideas. You can also give us a call at 860-275-7266 as we talk with Governor Malloy here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, with the pressure to excel weighing heavily on elite students and STEM fields being touted as the sure path to successful futures, what kind of environment are top colleges really providing these days? We're going to talk with the author of a controversial book called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Hope you can join us for that conversation. Today in the program, we're talking with Governor Dan Malloy. He's the governor of the state of Connecticut. It's the first time he's joined us during his second term, and we're glad to have him here answering some of your questions. We're going to turn to some important issues that he's been raising around transportation. Thomas will kick us off. Thomas is calling, I think, from Washington, D.C. Hi, Thomas.
That's right. Good morning, Governor. Good morning, Mr. Dankosky. I guess wanted to start, the bring around of the conversation to transportation with two very different issues, I guess, on the opposite end of the scale. First, I wanted to, I know that the governor, I read his plan about transportation, and I'm very enthusiastic and, thankful to see that he has some great ideas behind it. But, of course, nobody ever calls into these sorts of things just with, thanks. And the first part I wanted to talk about was the lack of prioritization of walkable streets. There's so many parts of the state where, especially with the snow on the streets right now, there's a real inability for people to get around unless they have a car. The shoulders are covered in snow and there aren't sidewalks in very, huge amounts of places.
Absolutely. We're dealing with it.
Walk.
Yep.
And, other end, I actually wanted to bring up, I have over the past several years, I'm just about to be graduating from UConn, and I've driven into New York and actually all the way down to D.C. Many, many times, but I very rarely make use of Metro North and the New Haven line. And, the two reasons I don't do that are cost and time. The Metro North line from New Haven still takes 2 hours to New York City, and it's $43 round trip. And while I'm really glad to see that your plan would involve modernizing that line, it also involves spending billions to widen I-95. And just from a personal standpoint, I would make use of that train 9 times out of 10 if it were,
Well, it's a little cheaper and ran more frequently. Thomas, thank you for the phone call. Go ahead, Governor.
So there is money. You said you read it. There is actually money for bike trails and walking trails, and it's a much larger amount of money than has ever been spoken about before. Initially, we want to repair some of the trails that exist, but we are actually talking about building new trails, bike and pedestrian trails, connecting town to town, particularly the downtown portions of towns that may be close to one another, and we want to encourage that. So that actually is very much in the plan, and it's a featured portion of the plan. Obviously, trails are a lot less expensive to build than highways or railways or even expansion of bus lines, but it is actually a featured portion. With respect to rail, let's be very clear. The early dollars, a very large portion of the early dollars in this 30-year plan will actually be built, be spent on rail, both the New Haven to Hartford to Springfield line as well as the Metro North line. What we envision, by the way, we want to add 6 stations to make it easier for somebody who might be traveling from stores to get to another station, a better connection point, so that maybe you go from stores to Hartford, you get on a train in Hartford, and you take that to Washington, D.C., as quite frankly my family members do on a fairly a regular basis. Making that easier, making that quicker, having that line be 2 lanes in its entirety as opposed to 3 lanes, and adding 6 stations along that are going to be very important. On the Metro North line, we want to rebuild the Merritt 7. We want to build a new station in Orange. We want to build a new station in Bridgeport. We want that system to work all 4 tracks. for a long period of time, we've been basically operating on in large stretches, two tracks, because we've been so slow in doing the catenary system. Let me give you this. The catenary, which is the electric system to power the trains, its modernization was complete in New York in 1995. We're still doing it in part because we parceled this thing out over such a long period of time to make sure that we had the dollars in any given budgetary year to pay for it. It was the wrong philosophy pursued by the state of Connecticut. Quite frankly, it was the philosophy pursued by the state of Connecticut for two generations. I'm trying to change that. So a lot of rail money to go to make sure that that's fully operational, four lanes, two basically on express basis, two basically what I would call subway service connecting the communities in the state. Rail is extremely important and will be done largely before highway improvement. But no matter how good a job we do with rail, it is not going to solve our highway program, our problem. We know that congestion on our highways is adding 40 hours of wait time to every working man and woman. But if you talk about in the corridor, say, between New Haven or Bridgeport and Greenwich, you're probably talking about 80 or 120 hours of congestion time. That's three work weeks, if I'm right, at the 120. And that's an estimate. We know it's 40 across the board. So rail dollars will be spent largely first. But let's be honest. We have a capacity problem on our highways that we have largely ignored and refused to address, and we need to address it on 84. We need to address it on 95, both of those roadways most particularly where we have the largest capacity issues that are restraining our growth as a state, particularly with respect to jobs.
Every major organization, whether it's a university or anybody else, who studies traffic congestion, studies urban planning, studies roadway building, says that by widening roadways, you create more congestion. More people get on the streets. Every single study that I've ever read, and we've done an awful lot of stuff on this, Governor, says that that's the case.
That is not true, particularly when it is accompanied by a major build-out of other systems of transportation. So that's why having a very robust system – we're going to spend $70 million in the next couple of years modernize the Waterbury branch. I want to have real commutation service, not just on the New Haven to Hartford to Springfield, but I want to have it on the entirety of the Waterbury branch. We're going to do those things on a concurrent basis, but basically the rail dollars will be spent first. But that's not going to solve the fact that 84 goes from two lanes to three lanes to two lanes to three lanes to two lanes to three lanes over its entirety. And that design defect adds congestion on that roadway. I mean, I would invite you, you live pretty far from here, but I'd invite you to ride that or drive that accordion road and understand what. Well, then you really know what the problem is. And part of the problem is you go from three lanes to two lanes. Every time you do that, you're causing a very substantial backup on that roadway.
And we just have a couple minutes left. Do we use some sort of passive toll collection to help to raise the money to do this? When we've asked Ben Barnes and others about this, they say tolls won't pay for all of it. But I'm asking, can tolls pay for some of what you're planning?
That's up to the legislature. What I'm trying to do is to develop a consensus, and I think it's actually developing, that we have to do something about transportation in Connecticut, that it's hurting our economy. There is an undisclosed tax to transportation in Connecticut right now. It is estimated, not by my state government and an independent study that you guys have referenced on this show, that congestion costs us $4.2 billion a year.
Absolutely.
$4.2 billion a year. That's much more than we would have to spend on a yearly basis to have a first-class transportation system. Will we get that day one? No. Now, my administration has increased spending on the capital side of transportation by 65% in the last 4 years. What we need to do is spend the next 5 years ramping up to a full-blown, large year-after-year-after-year expenditure to implement the changes that we need to make if our economy is going to be sustained in Connecticut. Otherwise, we can go back to that sleepy place where we don't compete for jobs and we get used to losing them on a regular basis.
We just have 30 seconds left, but one of the big questions is with all these plans, because obviously we all think that our transportation system needs to be fixed and changed. Where do we start to get the money for this?
Well, part of it is, and my administration has done that, is to recommit assets to transportation that were being spent elsewhere. There's lots of ways to pay for it. do you want to pay for it? And which is, I think, a way of asking the question, do you want to have a first-in-class transportation system or not? If we decide that that's what we want, then let's sit down and figure out how to pay for it. If we decide that we'd rather complain about transportation for the next 40 years as we have in Connecticut and not do away with that issue because we need conversation around the table, then let's not spend the money.
Governor Malloy, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming back in. Hope to see you a lot during the course of 2015.
All right.
Next time we'll have those beers that we were talking about at the beginning of the program.
We were out there one time together.
At the Hooker Brewery. We need to do that again. You can continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.